From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, solo timpanist Jonathan Haas. He performs with orchestras and a jazz ensemble, has rediscovered forgotten jazz and classical compositions for timpani, has commissioned and premiered new works by Philip Glass and Karlheinz Stockhausen, and has played with Aerosmith and Black Sabbath. Also today, British crime writer Jake Arnott. His first novel was a bestseller in England and is being made into a miniseries by the BBC. For his new novel, He Kills Coppers, Arnott looked back to the tabloids of 1960s London. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Senate Judiciary Committee has rejected President Bush's nomination of Federal District Judge Charles Pickering to serve on a federal appeals court. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
Every one of the 10 Democrats on the Judiciary Committee voted against Pickering's nomination, while every one of the 9 Republicans on the panel voted for the Mississippi judge, who's a close friend of Senate Minority Leader Trent Lott. Democrats faulted Pickering's record on civil rights and charged he was too ideological to serve in a venue that's just below the Supreme Court. Ranking Republican Orrin Hatch complained that Pickering was a victim of a smear campaign by what he called left-of-mainstream special interest groups.
It is definitely not a comforting sign for what lies ahead for other circuit court nominees, much less Supreme Court nominees.
The Judiciary Committee did not recommend that the full Senate vote on Pickering's nomination, as Republicans have demanded. The White House has not ruled out President Bush giving a recess appointment to Pickering. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
The Justice Department has announced an indictment charging that Arthur Andersen accounting firm with obstruction of justice in the Enron case. The one-count indictment accuses Andersen of widespread and systematic destruction of documents and computer files related to its audits of Enron. Andersen responded with a statement accusing the Justice Department of abusing its power. Israeli troops and tanks have begun pulling out of the West Bank city of Ramallah. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports dozens of tanks were seen leaving the city.
Well, Israel Radio reported that Israeli tanks have begun withdrawing from Ramallah and that military officials say that they expect the withdrawal to be complete by early tomorrow morning. If you remember, late on Monday night, about 150 tanks and armored personnel carriers went into Ramallah. Since then, there's been a virtual curfew on the city. Most people have been inside their houses since then. I was in Ramallah yesterday, and there really is quite a bit of damage to buildings, to streets, electricity lines, and water mains.
NPR's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. The order to withdraw from Ramallah came as U.S. Envoy Anthony Zinni began his effort to bring about a ceasefire between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Attorney General John Ashcroft announced an indictment today against Ahmed Omar Saeed Sheikh, the man accused of organizing the kidnapping of a Wall Street Journal reporter in Pakistan.
A grand jury in the District of New Jersey has returned an indictment charging Saeed with hostage taking and conspiracy to commit hostage taking resulting in the death of Daniel Pearl.
The suspect is currently being held in Pakistan, where officials say he'll have to face Pakistani justice before they decide whether to extradite him. In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 15 points to close at 10,517 in active trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index lost 8 points. This is NPR News. U.S. and Canadian soldiers fought a 90-minute gun battle today with enemy fighters in eastern Afghanistan, killing 3. Canadian reporters in the field said there were no U.S. or Canadian casualties in the fight, which took place during a mopping-up operation. More than 150 workers at O'Hare and Midway airports in Chicago are not going to be allowed in secure areas. Chicago officials say they've discovered the employees have criminal backgrounds. Lisa Labas reports from Chicago Public Radio.
Background checks turned up 37 different crimes, including murder, extortion, and kidnapping. The histories were found after workers' fingerprints were compared with an FBI database. Chicago Aviation Department spokesperson Monique Bond says 167 workers have been denied ID badges that would have given them access to secure areas. Workers will not be allowed on planes, ramps, or in baggage checkpoint areas. After the September attacks, the federal government required any worker allowed in secure areas would be subject to background checks. Bond says anyone who doesn't have a suitable explanation of their alleged history will not qualify to work in a secured area. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Labus in Chicago.
The Bush administration is considering whether to combine the Food and Drug Administration and the Agriculture Department in an effort to protect the nation's food supply from bioterrorism and other threats. Homeland Security Chief Tom Ridge said the administration might consolidate the inspection programs run by the two agencies. The FDA currently has responsibility for the safety of almost all foods in the United States except meat and poultry, but it has far fewer inspectors than the Agriculture Department. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jonathan Haas, is a soloist on an instrument that's usually relegated to a supporting role, the timpani, a.k.a. the kettle drums. He's rediscovered forgotten classical and jazz compositions for timpani and has commissioned and premiered new works by Philip Glass and Karlheinz Stockhausen. He also has his own jazz band and is the principal timpanist in the New York Chamber Symphony, the Aspen Chamber Orchestra, and the EOS Ensemble. He's the principal percussionist of the American Symphony Orchestra. If this hasn't convinced you of his versatility, consider that he's also recorded with the heavy metal bands Aerosmith and Black Sabbath. Let's start with a track from his jazz recording, Johnny H. and the Prisoners of Swing. This is the Duke Ellington composition, The Twitch. It was arranged by xylophonist Ian Finkel, who plays in the band and co-produced the CD with Haas. Duke Ellington composition, The Twitch, with my guest Jonathan Haas on timpani. Jonathan Haas, welcome to Fresh Air. Would you describe the timpani set that you use on that track?
Well, the timpani are usually found in the back of the orchestra, but in the Twitch with my jazz ensemble, Johnny H. and the Prisoners of Swing, they're out in the front playing with all the standard jazz instruments. So in this recording, I used 8 timpani.
Now, I know you're trying to expand the timpani repertoire. What are the typical parts that the timpani are used for in classical music and in film scores?
Well, the best description of the timpani is the second conductor. That's what my teacher, Saul Goodman, used to describe our job as. And not only are we keeping the time for the orchestra, but the pitch that the instrument produces is very important to both to the melody and to the harmonies in any orchestral piece. The timpani is a very low instrument. It's amongst the lowest pitched in the orchestra. And it's looked over because of that, sort of, I like to call them the low boys. And it's like the heartbeat. I mean, you have to have a heartbeat to stay alive, so symphonic pieces need the timpani. And since we're in the back, we're not as visible as other instruments would be. We certainly are there and serving an important role.
What are some of your favorite pieces that are kind of familiar pieces that use a lot of timpani?
Well, I think the most famous timpani piece is the Zarathustra, the Strauss, because we heard it in 2001. It was the opening of with the C and the G going bum, 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 bum. And then everybody recognized the instrument. Probably my favorite piece is either The Rite of Spring by Igor Stravinsky, and then the Mahler Symphonies, of course, are some of the greatest timpani parts ever written.
Now, you have a classical CD, and one of the compositions on it is by Johann Fischer, who was an 18th century musician, and you play his symphony for 8 timpani and orchestra. Tell us a little bit about this piece and how it was rediscovered.
Well, that's how it all started. I was in a music library just going through catalogs of pieces, and I stumbled upon George Grushetsky, who's considered sort of the Hungarian Haydn, if you would. And there was a piece at the Lincoln Center Library for the Performing Arts in which was noted a concerto for a timpani and orchestra. And that began a whole series of phone calls and letters written to Budapest. And I finally found the pieces. There's actually a number of them. One is a partita for six timpani and orchestra, the Druszewski Concerto for Oboe, eight timpani and orchestra, and then Johann Fischer also wrote a piece for a timpani and orchestra. So at that point, I decided not only to find the pieces, make editions of them, then, of course, we had to make a recording of it because people wouldn't believe it.
And what would you say about how Fischer uses timpani in this piece?
The timpani are used as a melodic instrument. That's why there's eight of them. And that was the intrigue, and that was the allure for me, because timpani is, I use it as a melodic instrument, not necessarily as a rhythmic instrument, although because it's percussion, you can't get away from that. But the timpani create a pitch. Each drum has a pitch. So if you have eight timpani, you have eight pitches, and that means the drummer can start playing melodies. And that was just the real kicker to do this, to have audiences see the drums, and then they discover that you're actually playing a melody that they can whistle to.
So you basically have a scale that you could play.
Exactly, have a scale.
So let's hear the opening of this Johann Fischer piece, Symphony for Eight Timpani and Orchestra. And you can hear the timpani playing the melody in part of this along with the rest of the orchestra.
That's right.
Jonathan Haas on timpani from his recording of 18th century concertos for timpani and orchestra. Jonathan, you were explaining that you used eight timpani in this recording, so you have a full scale. But what you don't have is all the accidentals, like you can't play any sharps or flats outside of what falls in a regular scale. Do you feel inhibited by that?
Well, since this was taking place in the 1700s, it certainly was groundbreaking, and it does sort of anchor me into the C major scale with certain minor keys that you can stray to, not many. So as a first try and as an historical event for the instrument, what it did is encouraged me to then find modern-day composers who then would write. They'd write in all the accidentals that the 17th century composers couldn't figure out how to do. And that's really as a result of the pedal mechanisms that now modern-day timpani have. We tune the timpani literally using our feet, very much like a harpist would. And this innovation really didn't exist in the 1700s. They used their what called our hand-tuned drums. So they had to use their hands to turn the turning knobs. There were about six of them on a timpani, and would take quite a while. So you couldn't change your pitches. Now we can play two octaves on one drum in about a nanosecond.
Huh? Do you have to have a really good sense of pitch a really good ear for pitch to tune the timpani?
The timpani absolutely requires a great ear, as they would say. The way that I approach it is that if I can sing something, if I can sing a part that I have to play, then I know I'm going to be able to play it on the timpani. It's a singing type of instrument. Unlike a guitar that has different strets on it where you can see where you can place your fingers, because we're tuning with our feet, you have to really just rely totally on your ear to know if you're in tune or not. And the timpani tend to go out of tune, especially when you use calf timpani heads, because of weather and climactic changes that it can occur in a concert hall during a concert. So you're always putting your ear down to the timpani and tapping so that you can hear the pitch. A lot of people think that we're smelling the drums or kissing them worse, but we're really tuning them when we bend over and listen to them.
And you have to do that sometimes during a performance?
Oh, all the time. I mean, if you're playing a piece by Bartok, the music for strings, celeste, and percussion, you're retuning all of the time. And, you're constantly making sure that you're in tune. And even while you're playing, you're actually hearing your tunefulness or tunelessness based on how you're doing in any particular time.
My guest is timpanist Jonathan Hawes. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is timpanist Jonathan Hawes. Like you said, in addition to trying to go back and rediscover early pieces that use timpani, you're trying to create a contemporary repertoire. You commissioned Philip Glass to write a piece for timpani. Why did you want Philip Glass to write something?
Well, I became enamored with his music a long time ago. I've followed all of his orchestral pieces, and then I was actually sitting in one of his films watching the Pauquatsi, and it dawned on me that he was the melodic composer that would be perfect to write a timpani concerto. And at the same time, coincidentally, I'd heard of a piece that he'd written called Prelude to Endgame that was used for the play, for the Beckett play. And he had written it for timpani and double bass. And at the time, Philip still had his phone number in the local 802 union book. So I just called him up, and I introduced myself, asked if I could come over to his house, and he invited me. He gave me the score to the piece, and then I rearranged it so that the timpanist played half of the double bass part while the double bass played half of the timpani part. So that way, I was playing melody besides just a rhythmic pattern. And then halfway through the piece, we switched back to the parts we're supposed to have. And when Philip heard this arrangement, he was thrilled. He enjoyed it. He thought it was very whimsical and fit very well in his composition. So that was sort of our beginning and our introduction to each other and my love of timpani and his understanding of how to write for the piece.
What does it take to commission Philip Glass?
Well, it took 10 years for me, because the first time out, I didn't get the grants that I needed to get in order to finance it. And then the second attempt, 10 years later, Meet the Composer was very generous and helpful in creating a fund and a granting for this concerto. And it also takes a certain amount of just stick-to-itiveness. My career as a timpanist, as you can probably imagine, has been wrought with lots of people telling me what I can't do, shouldn't do, and what won't be possible to do. And although I've taken everybody's word with great respect, I really ignored it all, because if that had been the case, I would have never done this to begin with. So it's sort of one of these against all odds, and when people said, well, you're going to be turned down, and a timpani concerto isn't something that's going to really interest grant-giving organizations, I had to stick it out. I had to wait it out, and and be patient.
There's actually, the Glass Symphony is actually for two timpanists, isn't it?
It's a double concerto, and the way that came about is that my very good friend and colleague, Catherine Cahill, who was at the New York Philharmonic at the time, had recommended to me that if I was going to commission a concerto, that I ought to do it as a double concerto. In other words, I play the concerto with the timpanist of the orchestra that I'm playing with. And the reason for that is that timpanists really don't get an opportunity as a soloist to play in front of the orchestra. So it was her feeling, and I thought she was right on with this, is that I'd have much more opportunities if I invited the timpanist of the orchestra that I was playing with to join me. And surely it has been an absolute, it was a brilliant move, on top of which it gave Philip Glass the opportunity for to write for twice the number of timpani that we originally had planned on. I play my part with seven timpani, and the other timpanist plays with seven. So that's 14 timpani, but it's not 14 notes because we have pedals now. So we have access to, you know, any note and every note that even a concert pianist would have, and that's why the concerto has the complexity and the depth that it has.
So let's hear the beginning of the piece that you commissioned from Philip Glass, the Concerto Fantasy for Two Timpanists and Orchestra. And my guest is timpanist Jonathan Haas. The beginning of Philip Glass's Concerto Fantasy for Two Timpanists and Orchestra. This piece was commissioned by one of the timpanists, my guest, Jonathan Haas. This recording has not yet been released commercially. Is there anything you do in this piece that you hadn't done before?
Well, just about everything, starting from being in front of the orchestra as a soloist. It was one of the experiences that I wanted to have as a timpani soloist that I hadn't had to date, except for playing the 17th century timpani concertos, which was a lot of fun and was the inspiration to continue on into the modern age. Besides that, the experiences include everything from having to be able to adjust to different concert halls with the type of timpani mallets you use, and because I've probably played with more orchestras now than different orchestras than any timpanist has in the history of music, 14 so far, that I've also had to learn how to adjust to different styles of the timpanist that I'm playing with my companion, as well as to fit into the sound of the orchestra, because I've played it now with everything from a chamber orchestra. Last week, I performed it with the Iris Chamber Orchestra in Memphis, and was a real adjustment from playing with the BBC in December with a huge orchestra. So there's been a lot of different experiences just in adjustment that have been very intriguing and a lot of fun to figure out.
Why did you want to specialize in timpani?
Well, I specialized in timpani first and foremost because I love the sound of the instrument. It's a very rarefied instrument. Unless you know what it sounds like and your ear is adjusted to it, you're not even sure many times that it's playing in a Mozart symphony or in a Haydn symphony, maybe even Beethoven. But I was drawn to it early in high school. I went to Neutra High School in Winnetka, Illinois, and we had an orchestral program where I played through all the Beethoven symphonies by the time I was done with high school, and that means I played timpani parts. So I had a real knack for it out of high school. And as a solo instrument, it really is the only instrument that wasn't investigated fully in terms of its capability, its capacity, and in particular, its ability to thrill audiences. So it being a unique instrument, it was a perfect match for me. I loved the sound. I wanted to have a career as a soloist. There were marimba soloists becoming very active, percussion soloists, but I wanted to find my niche, which was on the timps.
Now, timpani are kettle drums. They're really big, and they're probably pretty expensive. So it's not like you can rehearse at home in your little bedroom when you're growing up. So how did you go about having drums to even play with?
Well, they began as a combination of dining room table and instrument to practice on. When I was living in Manhattan, I had a studio apartment, and at the time I'd bought 4 Goodman timpani made by my teacher and put them in the apartment, and basically it was that and a sofa, and when I ate dinner, I put a board on top of the timpani, and that was the table. They are heavy, and they're real big. In fact, I'm building one now that's going to be 70 inches in diameter. I'm building the world's largest timpani. Many people ask me why, and it's sort of like, why would one climb Mount Everest? Well, if you're a timpanist, then you should build a 70-inch timpani and see what it sounds like. But that goes with the territory. Now I have a very successful percussion rental company, and there's very experienced people who pack my instruments and ship them all over the world, actually. And it's actually because it's just a well-oiled machine, but a heavy one.
Jonathan Haas is the principal timpanist in the New York Chamber Symphony and the Aspen Chamber Orchestra. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a cop, a cop killer, and a tabloid reporter. We talk with British crime writer Jake Arnott, author of the new novel He Kills Coppers. His first novel, The Long Firm, is being adapted into a miniseries by the BBC. Also, more with timpanist Jonathan Haas. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with timpanist Jonathan Haas. He's a soloist who's performed with many orchestras and is the principal timpanist with the New York Chamber Symphony and the Aspen Chamber Orchestra. He's commissioned and premiered works by Philip Glass and Karlheinz Stockhausen and has performed with the heavy metal bands Aerosmith and Black Sabbath. He also has a jazz band. He thinks of timpani as a solo instrument. When you're playing with an orchestra and you're not doing the pieces that are for timpani, but the timpani is just kind of a part of the piece, do you have to wait a long time for your few measures?
There's a lot of sitting around, and actually that sitting around time was time that I devoted to thinking about things like commissioning Philip Glass.
Right.
So, you sit around a lot, and sometimes you read a book. Other times we're talking to our friends in the orchestra and getting in trouble in the back. I mean, that goes back to high school.
So, like, during a rehearsal, you might just be reading a book, even though you're in with the orchestra, but you have, like, 10 minutes of sitting out maybe before your part.
Oh, yes. Most timpanists are very well read.
Right. Now, when you were growing up, were you just listening to classical music, or were you also listening to whatever the pop music of the day was?
Well, I'm really mostly interested in rock and roll. That's where I came from in high school. Besides playing this wonderful orchestra, really was in rock bands. I would say the majority of percussionists, timpanists in the United States who were growing up in the late 50s and 60s were in some sort of rock band or possibly a jazz band.
Yeah, but there aren't timpani in your average garage band.
Well, Ginger Baker made the timpani as famous as can be in White Room, and when I heard him playing timpani on those tracks in White Room, I was hooked on both styles of instrument from then on.
So did you play timpani in your own rock band?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't miss having that opportunity. It's something I'd like to do actually more is to play more rock and roll, and maybe with the 70-inch timpani that I'm building, it's the perfect vehicle to form a rock band around.
And I've read that you played with Aerosmith and Black Sabbath. What was the context for that?
Well, I was the timpanist on some recordings, Armageddon. There's a nice little timpani part in the background. And I'm a member of the orchestra playing on those tracks. And my rock and roll experience goes back to Emerson, Lake & Palmer, who went on tour in 1979. We were supposed to go on a world tour, but because of the economy and some lighting poles that fell down on our first gigs, we went out for about 2 months, and I was the percussionist and timpanist with Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. So I got a really good taste of playing in arenas with 30,000 people screaming and yelling and just having a ball, and having a timpani mic'd up to about a trillion decibels, and just had a ball doing it.
Where do you rehearse now?
Well, for the concerto, I have a studio built in the basement of my house, and I've had it soundproof so that my family doesn't have migraine headaches all day long. And at this point, I've played it enough where I don't practice it a lot. I don't need to because I remember it. But I have a studio in my house. I used to have a place when I was going to school. Down on 8th Avenue, it was called the Music Building, and it's still there. It's on 8th Avenue and 38th Street. And I remember I would come back late at night with my concert tails on from Carnegie Hall and with 5-6 timpani, and in the middle of this neighborhood that's, for a better way to characterize it, it's very colorful, carrying my timpani up these stairs up to a little tiny rehearsal room up in the Music Building, which was basically filled with heavy metal bands.
Hmm. It sounds like being a timpanist is actually a pretty expensive affair, especially if you want to, like, have drums made and have drums shipped and soundproof your basement.
Being a timpanist is a labor of love, without a doubt. The instruments, they're large and they are expensive. But like anything, it's all within context. I certainly wouldn't compare myself to somebody who has to buy a Stradivarius violin. We're not in that price range, and that in essence, any musical instrument that you fall in love with, that you become an advocate for, all of those sorts of things, how big they are and how expensive they are, become really very trivial in comparison to the music that you want to make with them.
I want to play something else from your jazz recording with your band Johnny H. and the Prisoners of Swing. And this is an excerpt of a suite you put together of music for timpani that was written to feature Vic Burton in the 1920s. Who was he?
Well, Vic Burton is one of my role models. I met his brother, actually, who's still alive in the New York area. And Vic Burton was a very well-known percussionist, a jazz percussionist, as well as a studio player. And he was playing with Red Nichols and the Five Pennies. And at a recording session in the 1928 in Chicago, there were some old beat-up timpani sitting in the corner of a room in the studio. And Red Nichols suggested to Vic Burton that he play something on them. And he took them out, and they recorded a very spontaneous recording session, the very first jazz timpani parts that have ever been recorded or known to anybody that I know. And that was really, when I was introduced to Vic Burton's music, I was really hooked on a whole new genre in which the timpani can exist.
And were you able to find the transcriptions for this?
There were no transcriptions. They were improvising. So what I did is I took the recording, which had about four or five pieces on it, to Ian Finkel, who's a virtuoso xylophonist and also a fantastic arranger who lives in New York. And he basically took the recording and transcribed everything that Vic Burton was doing, and then created a jazz ensemble and sort of gussied up the timpani parts, made them a little more complicated, made them a little bit more interesting to play. And that was really the beginning of Johnny H. and the Prisoners of Swing, thanks to Ian Finkel's great artistry.
Well, why don't we hear this recording? And Jonathan Haas, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
This is Johnny H. and the Prisoners of Swing playing Delirium. Music from the CD Johnny H. and the Prisoners of Swing, featuring timpanist Jonathan Haas. Coming up, British crime writer Jake Arnott. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Jake Arnott, is a British crime writer whose first two books have been very well reviewed. His first novel, The Long Firm, was a bestseller in England and is being made into a five-part series by the BBC. His second novel, He Kills Coppers, has just been published in the U.S. In the Sunday New York Times book review, Hugo Lindgren wrote, "Like the best crime novels, He Kills Coppers is really not about crime or even about criminals. It's about cultural disintegration, a city stuck in the shadowy interlude between the end of empire and whatever was coming next." Arnott positively revels in the filthy, rotting decadence of gangster-era London, spinning a tale that has the authority of well-researched fact and the felicity of fiction. The story revolves around three men, Billy Porter, who kills three cops in 1966 in London and disappears into assumed identities, Frank Taylor, the partner of one of the murdered cops, and Tony Meehan, the tabloid journalist and closeted homosexual who breaks the story of the cop killings. Let's start with a reading from the point of view of the tabloid journalist.
I suppose I'd always wanted to write. Ever since I can remember, I was making things up, telling tales, nasty stories. But this creativity was never nurtured when I was a child, never understood. You're a dirty little liar. My mother's own words. Can you imagine the effect of such an accusation on a young mind? I did well at school, but I got into trouble. An unpleasant business that meant that I left earlier than I might have done. I wasn't expelled, but the headmaster asked me to leave. Mother was very upset. But she never saw my side of the story. I worked as a clerk in a pickle factory for 2 years. I did shorthand at night school and got a job as a junior reporter on the Reading Mercury. Not terribly exciting, I must say, but at least I was writing. I stuck that for a year or so, but as soon as I'd saved enough money, I came up to London and got away from Mother at last. I had some mad idea that it was here I would become a great writer. I got a cheap bedsit in West London, just a few meagre possessions, a Remington typewriter, a battered chest of drawers that I improvised as a desk. I was a loner. I'd always felt different, apart from people, like Colin Wilson's Outsider. I was an existentialist, I decided. As with Barbusse's hero that Wilson refers to, the man outside, I had come to the capital with no genius, no mission to fulfil, no remarkable feelings to bestow. I have nothing, and I deserve nothing. Yet in spite of it, I desire some recompense. I was meant to be a writer, I felt. This could be my revenge, my way of getting back at them all, my way of articulating the painful solitude. The problem was, what to write about? I waited in vain for inspiration. I managed a half-finished draft of a novel. Derivative stuff, purple prose and descriptions of emotions I'd never felt. I couldn't bear to look at it. I kept it in a shoebox under my bed, collecting dust. I had this received notion that a novel should be somehow autobiographical, that fiction should be personal. But the very thought of it made me feel sick. I didn't want to write about myself. I had no desire to express my inner feelings. On the contrary, I wanted to use ink the way an octopus does, to hide. The money ran out, and I started doing bits of freelance journalism. I had the basic skills for it, after all. The gutter press was teeming with life, with stories. I found what I was looking for, a peephole to look through. I particularly liked crime stories. The more brutal, the better.
That's Jake Arnott reading an excerpt of his novel, He Kills Coppers. Jake, would you describe the tabloid reporter and how he fits into the novel?
Well, Tony's sort of a well-adjusted psychopath. It's funny that apparently there are more psychopaths out there than we imagine there are, and some of them lead quiet lives of anonymity. Of course, Tony is attracted to the sort of crime journalism, the tabloid crime journalism that's really wolfed down by the public, because he is drawn to some of those impulses himself.
Is part of the research you had to do to research what the tabloids in London were like in the 60s and how they covered crime and what the crimes were?
Mm-hmm. I spoke to a guy who'd worked on the news desk at the Sunday People all through the 60s and the 70s. And so I got a lot of the colour of what was then the British press. Fleet Street, it was called. It's completely changed now. It's all become computerised and moved out to Docklands. But back then, it had a particular character to it that I wanted to capture.
What did you want to capture about that character?
Well, it's the seediness, really. I mean, this is sort of what I do, the kind of dark side of society. And there was something quite gloomy and almost gothic about the sort of Fleet Street life.
What were the big crime stories in 1966 when part of your novel set?
Well, the central crime in the novel is based on a real event that happened just a few days after the World Cup final, and it was a very hot summer, Time magazine had just called London the swinging city. Everything seemed to be going well, and suddenly three unarmed police officers got gunned down in broad daylight in a West London street. And even now in Britain that would be quite shocking, but back in 66 it was a sort of a really disturbing event.
The title of your novel is He Kills Coppers. Can you talk about where that title comes from?
Yes, it's a football chant. It was a chant sung to the tune of London Bridge is Falling Down. And originally it was a chant about the cop killer that I base my fictional cop killer on, somebody called Harry Roberts. And it would go, Harry Roberts is our friend, is our friend, is our friend. Harry Roberts is our friend. He kills coppers. And I'm very interested in kind of modern mythology and sort of sort of things that are folkloric in an urban sort of age, and this was one of them. It's extraordinary when somebody in a very modern age becomes a sort of folk devil or a folk hero to some people, and I felt this song sort of reverberating down through the ages.
Why did that cop killer become a folk hero in some areas?
It's an interesting question. I think all sorts of things came together at the same time. In the 60s, when the event happened, there was a lot of social change. But generally then, the police would have been considered to be very well trusted by the majority of society. They were also up to no good, because they had such a free hand. Then as things slowly did change through the 60s and 70s, a lot of young people felt more instinctively oppositional towards the police. And people generally, because of the corruption trials that happened in Scotland Yard in the 70s, a lot of just ordinary people lost the sort of blind faith they had in the police as well. So it's funny, I ended up writing quite a lot about the history of the police force, but seen at different angles, really. And often by the crowd themselves. Often, a few times in the book, there are sort of set pieces where it's the crowd that are the character, not individuals themselves.
When you were growing up, were you exposed to a lot of crime or pretty well sheltered from crime?
A little bit of both. Nothing serious. But I did get quite consistently in trouble when I was younger. But nothing hugely sort of... I was no great criminal mastermind, let's put it that way.
Shoplifting, things like that?
That sort of thing, yeah, yeah.
What about in your neighborhood? Was it a crime-ridden neighborhood, or was it a pretty calm?
No, it was pretty suburban and quite calm. But the city, you see, London was always the thing that drew us in, you know, to go out, because it was near. And I always wanted to sort of come down to the big city.
You left school at the age of 16, is that right?
Yeah.
So I figure you must have had some authority issues as a young man.
I certainly did. I think, looking back, I think, God, what a handful, really. But it is, yeah, I didn't get on with secondary school, and I didn't really get on, I suppose, with things around authority when I was growing up. I think I wasn't very happy about myself as well. I wasn't really sure about all sorts of things about myself, and I really needed to go off and sort all of that out, really.
And what were the things about yourself that you had to settle?
I think about... A lot had to do with my sexuality, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Other things as well. But I didn't feel... I felt terrified by the whole prospect of being... about being not normal.
Right. What is the whole coming out kind of thing?
Sort of, yeah, yeah, yeah.
My guest is Jake Arnott. His new novel is called He Kills Coppers. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is British crime writer Jake Arnott. His new novel is called He Kills Coppers. You lived in squats for a while when you were, what, in your teens?
Late teens and through my 20s, yeah.
So basically these are like abandoned homes that you...
Yeah, that you occupy. There was a lot of unoccupied property in London at that time. So it was quite widespread.
One of the jobs you took on when you were young was working at a mortuary. What kind of work were you doing?
Well, it's a medical school mortuary, and I was, well, my official title was a technician, but essentially I was a glorified cleaner. Though I did assist in the odd embalming here and there. It was pretty grim stuff I had to do, I have to say.
It's stuff that comes in handy, though, for crime writing?
Well, it's funny, I haven't used it as much as I might. Certainly with Tony's sensibility, the journalist, I use that sort of sense of morbidity I could plug into.
Why did you decide to write about crime?
I'm not sure if I did make that decision consciously. I started with the first book, The Long Firm. I knew I was going to write about a criminal who was homosexual, and from the eyes of one of his boyfriends. But then it expanded into a big novel, and I realised it was going to be sort of a novel that would involve gangland in the 60s. And so then the second book came after that. I don't think I'm a crime writer per se, but I am fascinated by crime as a way of looking at society.
There are some gay activists over the years who have protested when homosexuals are depicted in a movie as the psychotic or the killer, because they fear that the implication is that homosexuality is a result of or leads to antisocial evil behavior. So as a writer who is gay and who has created a killer who is homosexual, what would you say to people who might argue that this is a bad depiction of homosexuality?
Well, I think there was a time when there was a lot of talk about the need for positive role models, and hopefully we've moved away from that, because I think a positive stereotype is just as bad as a negative stereotype. And I think that it's important to feel that one's experience, and whatever it is universal and human. Actually, in the first book, I based Harry Starks on a real-life London gangster who was homosexual. And I always thought, I mean, he's certainly not a positive role model, but for me, he always gave me a sense that there's a broad human experience here. It's not confined to a particular type. And I think that can be quite liberating. I think we need villains as much as we need heroes.
And that's where you come in, huh?
Yeah, I can provide them.
What were some of the things that you went through, either individually or in a kind of larger social, political way, that had the biggest impact on you, either artistically or politically?
I think when my house burnt down, I was squatting in this lovely house in South London, and I came home one night and there'd been a fire, and suddenly I was homeless. Also, all my possessions had been burnt in the fire. And then, just as we were trying to organise things, the police turned up and arrested us all on suspicion of arson. So in one evening, I lost my home, my possessions and my liberty at one fell stroke. It was extraordinary. It was sort of months before I got back onto some sort of normal track of things. But it did have a profound effect on the way I thought about, not so much politically, but just the very sort of notion of existence, really, that suddenly everything can just go.
And did that make you, as the croupier would say, hold on tightly or let go lightly?
It definitely makes you let go lightly. I mean, it was kind of instant Buddhism. I wouldn't recommend it, but... strangely enough, there was a feeling of being able to let go of all these things, because none of them really matter that much. Of course, then I also there was a lot of frustration and anger I felt about things as well at the same time. But I'd say, I suppose the things I miss most were maybe things I'd written, maybe things, letters, photographs that you couldn't reproduce. It's things that almost have a cultural significance rather than a material significance. You know, anything else can be replaced, or, you know, it's not that important anyway. It's only an object.
Jake Arnott, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jake Arnott's new novel is called He Kills Coppers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Sherrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Amy Sallet, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By Audi and the all-new A4. Information is available on the web at AudiUSA.com or 1-800-4-AUDI. And Dell Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Advanced Cinema Therapy, The Girl's Guide to Finding Happiness One Movie at a Time by Nancy Pesky and Beverly West. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Listen to Terry Gross, Fresh Air. Mel Brooks is her guest.
We'll not only hear from Mel Brooks, we'll feature highlights of interviews with Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick. Sunday is their last performance in Mel Brooks' hit Broadway show, The Producers. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.